Well, I see the people have been getting here and there a little bit of this processing. Some of them look terribly gloomy, having been stuck somewhere on the track. Some of them look very cheerful. The new data which this conference is getting, which is not in printed form, and will probably take an edition or two of the new handbook to get in, is the resolution of the life continuum phenomenon. How do you resolve it? What is it? It's new data on this. Workable. If you're ever going to produce very many miracles, you're going to have to resolve this life continuum. Because believe me, you're people who are in terrible condition. Even your little kids have gratuitously and pleasantly taken upon themselves somebody else's existence and has sought to resolve a failure on the part of somebody else. And a failure, of course, is simply a loss of one sort or another, whether by departure or loss of potential of some individual. You take some little kid and you find them sick of something or other and you try to do something for them, and what do you find is the source of it? You find that they got sympathetic toward Gracie Ann. So they found Gracie Ann was very ill, and they were told a terrible sob story about Gracie Ann. And maybe Gracie Ann was very sick and got in very bad condition. And so the little kid says, well, there we are. Stays in bed for a year. Sick. It sounds odd that anyone would do this. You have to work a few cases, look at your own case a couple of times to find out this. Because you'll find out that the incidents which do not easily give up are those incidents which are occasioned by this life continuum phenomenon. Valence shifting is actually no more and no less than this sort of proposition. But valence shifting is not just into somebody else's valence and then we go on from there. A person can be in a multiple or complex valence situation. They can be holding on to many valences, or they can be in no valence, or they can be in a synthetic valence. You've been worrying in the past about shifting people into their own valence by just telling them to shift into their own valence. Well, the funny part of it is they will. And then they can run the thing out. But if you shifted them into their own valence and then you didn't run it all the way out, your preclear was in for trouble. So we'll stop worrying about what the preclear is doing with regard to valence and start worrying about what the preclear is doing with regard to life continuum. You see how that would be? If you run into some situation which is revealed to you by effort processing, whereby the individual seems to be in some kind of a death, regardless of when or where or how, he's probably doing a life continuum with himself. Or if he is in a severe operation where he thinks he died, he will then do a life continuum with himself. Well, what's himself? It's a person being operated on. Now you see how this would work. So, at this moment, let's use valence only as an estimate of the case. Stop working with it as valence. Start working with it on the terms of life continuum. If an individual is out of valence, if he is seeing himself, in other words, when he is returned to an incident, if he's viewing himself, he's doing a life continuum for somebody. And very often, when he is solidly inside himself, he may very well be doing a life continuum for himself. See how this could be? If he's in himself and everything's foggy and occluded and upset and so forth, and yet he's still in his own valence, he's probably continuing his own life from some point, which is in restimulation. Theoretically, a person starts out in life with a free, clear, control center. It starts getting aberrated relatively soon. There's material on record which you don't have to bring up to your pre-clears or even mention, really, in public. Really, because you have to, if you want to prove it, you have to throw somebody down on the couch. That's too much work. They don't believe it. So they don't believe it. Well, just don't incite people's incredulity by throwing a lot of odds and ends of strange phenomena at them. You can throw some very interesting phenomena at them without doing that. Just show them themselves. That's a shocker to most people. Their present time self is enough phenomena to rock them because they aren't looking at the present time self. They are not solving their problems in any way, shape, or form, usually, in present time. They're trying to solve them in the future or the past. Their life is built of straw, and from straw to straw, there is a large bridge of if. So this life continuum can actually begin with conception. Something bad happens during a conception, or the first mitosis, and the person begins to continue his life from there. Could be, you see. So that you can get a life continuum from an engram. Well, that's the easy case. That's the case, you know, you say snap, snap, run, run, snap, bang, he's fine shape. That happens every once in a while. In fact, very frequently. A little bit of just straight processing. Auditor doing no thinking, nothing. All of a sudden, this case is back to battering, doing beautifully. Well, what the auditor's done is resolve the life continuum of himself, which was interrupted by some major incident in his life, regardless of where that incident was on the track. Or it can even be that the individual's hung up in one of his own past lives. But the usual thing is that a person does a life continuum and becomes aberrated thereby. Now, you can process this person, you can make them happier, you can make them more successful, and everything else, but it's something like doing a dance with the real aberration. And I don't know how long you could process him, you would still be doing a dance with the real aberration. It'd still be there. What you've done is shape him up to a point where he can suffer it or bear it. Well, of course, he'd come up to a point where he could suffer it or bear it almost immediately if you could resolve it. Well, that thing is this life continuum. You start running all the sympathy on a case. There's going to be failures and deaths on the part of other people which show up. You just start running sympathy. Just start scanning the feeling of sympathy, just in general. And the person will all of a sudden start pinning it down here and pinning it down there. And he'll all of a sudden remember a lot of things in his life that he didn't remember before. Just that all by itself. Now we take regret. Or we take an approval, desire for or giving approval. And we just run those things. We find an individual has, whether he goes, gets them while he's asleep or gets them while he's awake, if he's got some sort of a visio, any visio, that keeps popping up. Usually it's a still visio. Usually it's too small or something of the sort. Just run regret on it. He gets a visio of a girl dancing, only she's in a dancing position, stopped or something like that. She might even be moving a little bit, doesn't matter. And you say, well, scan some regret off of it. And he says, why? This is obviously a ballet I attended, Swan Lake, and a very pretty ballet, and I enjoyed it. Say, scan regret off of it. So he says, all right. All of a sudden, I killed my older sister. Well, how did you get there? Well, he remembers his older sister as having studied ballet. Oh, boy, does this make you smart auditors. if he can't get a Vizio on somebody he knows he knew, can regret. Just that, regret, regret, regret. If he gets a Vizio, can regret, regret, regret. All of a sudden, the computation of the case will fall into your lap. Very interesting. Tough technique. Now, the next thing that goes to it, after you start getting this regret, you'll find that there's blame to be found on it. That's the second step. There's blame. So you say, all right, let's scan some blame off of this. Well, I don't blame myself for anything about this. Just scan some blame. But I don't blame myself. I know I don't blame myself. Please scan blame on this. Just the feeling of blame off of this. Oh, yes. If I hadn't have taken the car that night, why, they would have been able to have gotten to the doctor and my little brother wouldn't have died. That's a lot of horse feathers, by the way. But, a person will find some cockeyed rationalization and then afterwards hold himself responsible for this life not having been continued, and he will promptly take over the aberrations and conclude the life. That is, say you keep it alive. Fascinating, isn't it? When he starts blaming himself, that's the last stages. Because you see, himself is somebody different than I. And when he starts blaming himself for it, you'll find him in the last stages down the tone scale. You can actually pick up the point in any person's life where, for the first time, he really actively blamed himself. It was that moment he broke from being fairly sane to not too well off. That was the instant. And it happens all in an instant in any man's life. It can get progressively worse with future blames, but you can find the first time he blamed himself as a sort of a break in a person's life from a free, happy existence. Now, you'll think you found the time. Maybe it was 10 years ago. And then you'll think you find the time again. Maybe that was 15 years ago. And then you'll get another time when he blamed himself, and that was 23 years ago. And heck, this guy's only 26. And we say, what goes on here? And then all of a sudden, it turns out that the little dog who ran across the street while he was sitting in his baby buggy was his fault, because he should have yelled. He didn't yell, and therefore the dog died. Something weird like this. He's already in pretty bad shape. He really starts blaming himself that early. He's had a rough prenatal, and he's had a lot of other things. Well, what is this thing we're monkeying with here? Life continuum? You can see that it exists. You can put your hands on almost any preclear, and you will find some semblance of it. You can look into your own case. You can find that there is something in your own case that demonstrates you are continuing the goals, fears, identity of somebody else. How come? And particularly, how would you be able to undo this thing? Now, the technique I've given you, run regret and run blame, does very remarkably well. If you just do that, you'll be all right. But there's a better one. Much better one. Has to do with the emotional curve. The use of the emotional curve. I told you the other day that interpersonal relationships, asked for a solution of interpersonal relationships and got this sudden drop of the emotional curve. If pain is associated with your little trick of making somebody else do a dive from happiness down to sadness or something of the sort. And if you can get blame for a somatic or something mixed up in the thing, in making a person get that drop, you know that person you were trying to help, you know that person that had that bad stomach somatic, that anxiety stomach somatic, you know, that you were trying to help. And, you know, he felt so well. He felt fine. And he's saying, yeah. You say, well, he's got it back and it's all occluded now. Nobody can get to it.
You'll give the guy the stomach somatic.
If you want to experiment with this, you can see it. He'll actually pick up an effort of his own, a counter effort of his own substitute. How's he do this? Well, by doing this, he evidently thinks that he can alleviate this other person. The whole field of faith healing was based on this premise. Let me tell you, I'd do faith healing. No trick. I'll tell you 3-4 minutes. 2 minutes, 30 seconds. Doesn't work. Anyway. You get this guy who has a epiglottis of the esophagus or something. The best way to do it, if you really want to do it well, is you put your hand on him and hypnotize him. Tactile communication, hypnosis, something of the sort. And then you say, now you can feel that pain coming off into my hand. The area is getting warmer and warmer and warmer, and the pain is coming off into my hand. Take your somatics back. So anyhow, he'll actually feel this area getting warmer and warmer and warmer and warmer and warmer and warmer and warmer, and then you say, all right, it's gone. You've given him a somatic shutoff. That's what you've done. And the funny part of it is that they're sometimes happier. So on. Of course, the real way you do faith healing is to be up over top static and into some other field or someplace, and you come along and there's somebody lying there and they're in horrible shape, and you say, whoosh, and they're in beautiful shape. Now, that would be the technical and theoretical way of doing it. Well, we aren't quite up to that point. We have to go. So, you see, when we get up to, I'll tell you. All right. This mechanism is easily explained out of the phenomena of survival and full responsibility, the mechanism of life continuum. Now, if you look in your advanced procedure handbook, you will find out that every individual potentially considers himself responsible or is responsible for everything on every dynamic that exists in the whole universe, including Alpha Centauri. And your glasses. And as he comes down the tone scale, he is electing out more and more and more things for which he is not responsible until he gets to the bottom of the tone scale when he's not responsible for anything, including himself, at which moment he's dead. You see what that gradient scale is? He actually starts in with this tremendous view. Then he starts losing parts of it. Now, that is full responsibility. You remember that chart there in the first book? It showed you infinite survival as being high tone. Well, how right can you be? You know that if you were completely, ultimately, absolutely right, that the universe would survive forever. Just like that. And if any person was completely, utterly, entirely wrong, probably we would all vanish. I mean, you've got this ridiculousness, the reductio ad absurdum, on the gradient scale. I mean, it says that absolute right means infinite survival clear across the boards for everything. That's how right a person would have to be absolutely right. The moment anybody reached that point, the whole thing would go into a static state. Let's hope they don't. I like movies and things. Well, down here at the wrong end, if a person were completely wrong, theoretically, everything would collapse. Those are the two unattainable opposite poles. But they are up the top of infinite survival. Infinite survival says if you are going to survive infinitely, then you have to take the responsibility for everything. I mean, there's no question about that. Simply because of this. Your survival is interdependent with all other survivals. And if you start knocking out everything here and there broadly and telling it not to survive and something else not to survive, you keep cutting down your old survival. Do not send to find for whom the bell tolls. It's ringing for you, bud. You get the idea. All right. Now, we've got this infinite scale, and as a person comes down this scale from complete survival, he's starting to drop down from complete responsibility. By responsibility, you have complete cause also. He is the cause. He considers himself the cause of these things. The dignity of a small baby is interesting to observe. People come along and they say, coochie coo, and so forth, and the baby looks at them. They don't like it. If you've been back there on the time track, you might have noticed the feeling of dignity, the feeling of way up the tone scale, little baby. People maul them around, and they giggle, and they laugh. That's to be obliging, and after a while, they become human. But the funny part of it is the trouble with the baby is he's having a little bit of trouble with his motor control panel. He's somebody that's suddenly been put into a big bomber, and he's got to find the... It's got eight engines, and each one's got separate throttles, and there's fuel mixtures over here, and there's buttons, wheels, gyrometers, hydrostatometers. It's terrific stuff. If anybody suddenly put you out here in one of these B-47s and said, well, take it off and land it again, that's a baby. It's not that the baby is incapable, it's just the baby is not articulating and he's not in control of the engine yet to any marked degree. Now, he does have this tremendous dignity. And you take some little kid, maybe running around the neighborhood, 3-4-year-old kid, he runs around the neighborhood, all of a sudden he sees a black wreath on a door. What did he do to cause this? It isn't that his parents have beaten his head in, giving him an aberration on the fact that he's to blame for everything. Don't try to answer it that way, because it doesn't answer that way. He wonders who, what he did, or what it was all about. And if this happens to be a relative of a playfellow, if it's a relative of a playfellow, he will try to pick up something to support this playfellow. In other words, an indirect method of bringing that relative back to life. Fascinating business. You'll find some very basic aberration on the track for having done this. All right. Here's full responsibility. Here's full survival. What's regret? What is regret? Regret is simply an effort to take something out of the time stream. I'm sorry it happened. I wished it hadn't happened. That's all. That's what regret is. I'm sorry it happened. I wish it hadn't occurred. Very heavy regret, of course, moves the incident out of contact. And the more you regret it, the more it goes out of contact. Regret is a mechanism of abdication of the post of great responsibility. I wish it hadn't happened. Why do you wish it hadn't happened? It's because it cuts down your full responsibility. You see, you weren't able to control, you think, that particular little segment of existence, so you regret it, so it goes out of existence. And that is the emotion of regret. Now let's look at survival, and let's look at approval. What is approval? What's approval? Way up top on the tone scale, a person doesn't hand out approval, doesn't receive approval. But as you get down into action, you'll find out that an individual, still very high on the tone scale, is handing out approval to people. He's approving of this one, he's approving of that one, and so forth. He's hanging out. He doesn't expect anything back, or any back channel on it, or anything of the sort. But after a while, he's in a co-approval basis. We used to call them mutual admiration societies. He's getting down the tone scale pretty far there. And after a while, he has to have approval from others. And he loses approval from somebody, and he starts out the bottom. Bang. What's approval? I could print you up a license to survive. You, John Jones, this umpteenth date, something or other, hereby granted a license to survive. Signed, Foundation. You know what would be very amazing? If we put those in the window of the foundation down there and said that anybody could have one merely by coming in, I'm afraid we could not keep up to supply. I'm afraid we couldn't. People wouldn't quite know why they wanted this. They think it would be a good gag and everything else, but they'd show it around. They'd ask their friends, ha, 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 ha. You know, and their friends would say, ho, ho. Don't quite see what's funny about it. I haven't got one. Approval is a license to survive. And you're either not caring whether you have a license or not. That's way up top. Or you're issuing licenses to survive, which is as you come down the tone scale. Or you have to exchange licenses. Or you have to receive licenses to survive. And when you're way down the tone scale, you have to have licenses from various people to survive. See how that could be? You've possibly wondered why it is that the poor little kid who is so snarled up about having been such a pain and terror to his mother when he was born. Oh, there's regret on this, and there's sympathy, and there's blame, self-blame. Oh, there's everything on this. This is a rough deal. Little kid, he caused his mother all this trouble, and she tells him about it every day. And we wonder why this is. Mama is insisting on something that isn't really true. That she was the sole cause of his survival, and therefore she licensed him to survive. This is not true. So he has to pay attention to his licensor as a licensee. Only he's running on a very, very, very limited ticket. You can't go here, you can't do this, you must do that, you can't eat this, you must wear that, you must get up, you must go to bed. Very limited ticket. It says 180 degree turns around front yard only. That's its outermost limit. And some of these tickets say limited to 360 degree turns in living room and bedroom. No passengers. Right to survive. That's approval. You think you have to have approval from anybody under the sun? You think you have to have a right to survive from somebody. 25, it is you are the only licensee and the only licensor to you. Look this thing over, and you'll find out that these situations come up along the line, and the way a person gets into this situation is not by being told or hammered into believing that he has to have this. There must be something actual and real for which the individual himself blames himself prior to being challenged on it. In other words, he has to elect to blame himself or blame something else first, before he starts asking for a license to survive. After a person has been done something wrong to another individual, he's hurt another individual in some way, he'll slide off if he does it and fails. That is to say, if he hurts somebody and then he looks at him and sees they're hurt, he realizes he's failed at that moment. He's failed in some degree. He feels sympathy. You want to find out what's behind sympathy? You go all the way back down the track, you'll find an overt act against that dynamic. Somebody just being mean as the devil. You find somebody who's very sympathetic about dogs, has big grief charge about dogs. And you go back and find them 5, 6, 7 years of age, and you'll find them kicking the slats in, teasing, beating up dogs. And then one day he actually hurt a dog.
And the dog suddenly looked pathetic to him. And he felt a great deal of sympathy about this dog. And after that, he was fond of dogs. He protected dogs. He worked with dogs. He was very quiet about the whole deal. And then one day, a dog died on him. He'll do a life continuum for dogs after that. He actually will. He'll have some habit or some activity in his actions, which will be a dog's. Because, you see, when a person has done a real overt act, a person is perfectly free to do all the overt acts in the world, so long as he doesn't fail. If he fails, he's extended an active sphere of responsibility. Now get the difference between full responsibility and active responsibility. Full responsibility is all the way up the top of the tone scale. You have to step down from it to go into action. You have to select something out. I am responsible, I'm going to do something about it. That is down tone scale. Not an undesirable level. You have to do that to get into the 20 band. You have to come down the scale. Because you're too static when you say, well, I'm responsible. Trucks colliding with little children and typhoid sweeping through the land and the Democrats about to get into office again. All of these cataclysms going on and the person just benignly says, yes, I'm responsible. Oh, you come down the tone scale, he's got to get in there and stop these epidemics and straighten out the kids and so forth. Well, as a matter of fact, the world wouldn't run at all if everybody insisted on being up at the top static of full responsibility. That's just ideal, not practical. Now you come down from that level, you go into action with your responsibility. The second you go into your action for your responsibility, you start cutting out segments for which you're responsible and you start blaming these things. You know, I'm not responsible for it. You're the cause of it. I'm not. I'm to blame. It was nobody's fault but my own. All this kind of stuff. That's cause and effect in action. A person is assigning cause to other things beside himself. Well, the second he does this, he's not responsible for these things. And he gets so bad off. Now, on approval, when a person has sinned. Wonderful word. Sinned. Against the human race in some fashion or other. There actually is a sin. The sin is failing. Just don't fail, that's all. Doggone it. And if you do fail, run it out. Simple. Now, an individual then riding at 20 is not fully responsible. Because he selected things out so that he can have action. I was going to ask somebody to get me a rubber ball here today, and they gave me a broom instead. But anyhow, because I wanted to show you randomity and action. That all ties in with this. You know, in those axioms, some of you have had maybe a little difficulty telling what randomity is. So I will ask you to imagine a rubber ball. I set this rubber ball here very neatly on this piano. You can all look at that rubber ball. Go ahead, look at the rubber ball. The second that you are asked to look at something which is apparently static, you start up your own randomity, don't you? There's no motion in that rubber ball. It's just sitting there. You become bored with it. That's the emotion that goes along. You could sit and contemplate one rubber ball or something of the sort for just so long without saying, so what? Okay. Now, we take this same rubber ball, and I take it, and I start bouncing it. And I say, now watch this rubber ball bouncing. You see, and I just start bouncing it like this. You watch that just so long, you see, rubber ball bouncing. You say, so what? You see, that's a different kind of a static. That is repetitive motion, which becomes monotonous. Now, if I were to bounce the rubber ball You'd say, very interesting. Or if I was to take the rubber ball, say, three rubber balls.
That's randomity. There's motion.
Erratic motion. Now, the optimum of erratic motion has on its near side minus motion, on its other side plus motion. For instance, you could hit this rubber ball like this, and it'd shoot off over there. And I'd have to go over and pick up the rubber ball and bring it back here. And then I would hit the rubber ball again, and it'd fly out in that direction. See, that's too much randomity. It's too erratic. So it isn't under control. Now, supposing one did this. I put the rubber ball down here. Not enough motion. That's minus randomity. You see, it's emotional reaction. There has to be some controlled eccentric action in motion. Relatively controlled, but there has to be eccentricity in action in order to hold your attention. That's what you desire from life. Monotony is to you death. It is a static. See? And a static is either something still or just a repetitive motion, so repetitive that it becomes, in that regard, utterly inane. A person who goes 9 to 5, 9 to 5, 9 to 5, 9 to 5, often Saturday, often Sunday, 9 to 5, 9 to 5, 9 to 5, 9 to 5, often Saturday, often Sunday, 9 to 5, 9 to 5, 9 to 5, 9 to 5, often Saturday, often Sunday. Particularly if every Sunday afternoon he goes to the same theater to see a movie. This person, after a while, becomes bored. Now, the oddness of it is that individuals have different tolerances for randomity. This 9-to-5 deal, to many people, appears to be even adventurous. And there are people in this audience who have stood and watched something like a subway train or a bus driver. And they said, how can that man go to the other end of the run and turn around and come back? And then turn around here and go back. And then turn around there and go back. And keep it up for 60 years or 30 years or something like that. You know you couldn't do it. You say, well, therefore there's something wrong with me. Yeah, there's something wrong with you. You desire a little more randomity than he does. Now, you talk to one of these boys and you say, gee, doesn't that just about drive you daffy? He says, what? And you say, running that bus. Running that bus. How do you mean? Do you realize I have to get up every morning at 6 o'clock, come down here, start the bus, get in there, get my change in order, so forth, and he starts going through this routine. You can see that it's just the damnedest, dullest routine in the world. And the only difference on change is sometimes they drop a dime when he's loading his... And sometimes it's Mrs. Snodgrass, not Mrs. Smith, who gets on the bus first at the first stop to get to her job. And there's whether Mrs. Snide up the street is going to go downtown today. Now, this is randomity to that individual. See? Your wild adventurer demands as randomity the cataclysm and crash of nations, societies, bang, crash, wham. Hitler, for instance, he's downtown scale for his desire for randomity, but I don't believe he was even satisfied when he was blowing himself up. There's millions dead and armies ruined and continents changed and shifted all over the place and people suffering in all directions. He's still going strong. A 1-5's idea of good randomity. His appetite for randomity was too high. And his idea of randomity was all plus. Too much. Now, on a constructive level, there can also be too much randomity for an individual. Any of you who have been bewildered from time to time at sudden advances in technique, you're getting just a little bit too much randomity. You just don't want quite this much randomity. In spite of the fact that the techniques are well ahead of your pre-clears. That is to say, if you'd taken the first techniques offered and you were still working them, probably a couple, 3 hours a week on a pre-clear and so forth, techniques have come along since that can produce this result, and they keep caught up with you. In other words, you're doing, with a new technique, a speed-up every time on the case. But what you're liable to start watching is this flood of new techniques. They're actually upsetting your randomity of snapping the fingers or something. They're altering this. Now, there's something else you should look at. You should be very pleased this is happening. I don't know anything really more boring than snapping the fingers at a pre-clear 6 hours a day, 6 days a week. That's pretty grim. So we're working a technique up where an auditor has a lot of randomity. Now, when a person comes down scale from full responsibility, he's moving into 20 for him. When he gets to optimum, he'll be optimally busy, but don't think he won't be busy. This fellow that says, I'm going to buy an orange grove and sit there. That's a goal, and it's pretty, but when he gets there and he sits down, he gets right back up again. Now, this is the boy who was advised that he better retire for his health and take it easy, control himself, take it quiet. All of a sudden, they bury him. They say, well, that's the way it goes with these fellows. They just work themselves all their lives too hard, and it gets them. It's a good thing he laid off and started to rest when he did. Now, an individual, if he's running at more or less optimum motion for him, is up above all of his past counter efforts. You get the idea. As he sinks down from those counter efforts or goes up from his optimum motion, he'll run into bands of lower speed for himself, so he'll start getting clipped by counter efforts. You get the idea? This is all very sequitur. I mean, that may sound to you for a moment that it's not making a complete package, but let me show you something. Here's 40, 20, 0. Now, on this 40-20-0 plot, here's optimum motion for an individual. Some guys will go out to a racetrack, and they'll watch these racing cars go round and round and round and round and round and round, and they go out next Sunday, and they watch the racing cars go round and round and round. What produces randomity there is the fact that they're going too fast, which fascinates him. And the next thing that it produces is the fact that every once in a while it's a crash, big crash. How a race driver can stand up to his own fans, I don't know. Out in Indianapolis one day, there was a race driver went over the rail, over the wall, rolled, so forth. The first people on the ground, the first thing one of them says, oh, gee, look what I got. He picked up a handkerchief that had fallen out of the fellow's chest and it was saturated with blood, still dripping. Anyway, that was his idea of randomity. Each individual has a potential capacity or a potential action level. That's just theoretical. Everybody, if brought to 20, would not be to a 20, it would be to his 20. A happy, healthy, exuberant, long-lived bus driver is a 20. He gets mum in the morning, he counts his change, he checks out, and goes to this end of the run, and he goes to that end. I see two or three people squirming. Anyhow, here's an emotional curve. Person's way up here, enthusiasm. He's up the level of enthusiasm. He comes in, he says, yabbity, 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 up. And somebody says, yam, yam, yam. And he goes... the shift in tone is quite marked. What happens here?
Up here,
he is running along so that he is running at a speed faster, and I'm sorry I can't phrase it any better than that. His motion, his amount of randomity, which he's encompassing and which he's engaged in and so forth, is up above the motion or speed of the counter-efforts which might threaten him. You understand that? The only way a counter-effort can threaten a guy is if it's faster than he is. Then he gets it. This is proven by the fact you sit a guy down very quietly and have him concentrate on a state of not beingness, he'll get his counter-efforts. Bang, you can demonstrate this on individuals. All right. It means, then, that when an individual is dropped in what we'll call speed, call this thing this internal governor or whatever it is, when the individual is dropped in speed, suddenly, he drops emotionally as well, and that is your emotional tone scale. Bang. And so, here, he's not suffering from any counter-efforts. He doesn't have anything. And then they say, well, that girl you worked on last night, you know, that had a terrible anxiety stomach and so forth and so on. This guy's all enthusiastic. He fixed her up and so forth. Well, she's in the hospital. What's posed there, he has decided to handle this anxiety stomach, this counter-effort. And it's suddenly he is informed that he didn't handle it. Now, his first reaction is to handle it, but he's been dropped down the tone scale to a point where he can't suddenly. Bang. You get an anxiety stomach. You want to run this test? You can run this test on individuals. You can give them a big build-up and a sudden drop. Only if you give them a big build-up and a sudden drop about an injury, they'll get the injury. It's fascinating. That's the doggondest thing. Now, anytime a preclear, you're working on a preclear, you work on them, you know you have the cause of it, you're running the thing out, you're in good shape, you can see their tone come up, and all of a sudden, they sit up and they say, well, I've still got my sore leg. The auditor goes, zing. How many auditors have unwittingly picked up a sore leg and didn't realize what its source was? You just check back over your cases. You check back over your auditing. And you'll find that sooner or later, something happened on it. Well, now, it doesn't happen right away. The reason why is the auditor, who is running up around above four, he's not doing too badly, till one day he gets carved down today this way. But his next curve is going to be that drop, you see. It's going to be that drop. It's going to be that drop. It's going to be that one. It'll be a flat line. He's come all the way down to where he can't handle his motion. Now, at that moment, cuts in as a chronic somatic. One of these things he missed on consistently in the past. You get the idea? His resilience at first is such that when this gag is pulled on him, he bounces. That's all right. He bounces. If he'd really looked at himself, he would have gotten a momentary twitch out of it. Back up again. But when he really gets smashed down along to that line, he's got then a chronic somatic, and he is not going to get rid of it until it is processed out on the life continuum factor. Since what's he done? He suddenly took over the responsibility of that somatic he failed on by wearing it himself. You see how this would be? This is, by the way, not very esoteric. If you think this over for a while, you'll see that we're talking in terms of weights and balances. An individual, as I, can handle motion. He starts handling motion. You're handling motion right now. The beat of your heart, the coursing of your blood, the various activities of the human body, its actions. You're bracing against gravity. You're doing all sorts of these motions. It's lots of motion. You ever watched a person as he comes down the tone scale? He gets to anger and he'll have a violent flare of relatively poorly directed motion, and then it's like sudden flash of a lamp bulb just before it goes out. He'll finally come down to where he just sits. Quieter, quieter, quieter. I told you about motion there and resistance to motion. Reaction to motion in comparison to this tone scale. He isn't handling leftover counter efforts. When you're a kid, baseball hits you in the eye. All right, fine. Baseball hits you in the eye. You're just fine. Years go by. You don't think about this baseball hitting you in the eye at all. But you hear about somebody who's got some friend of yours that you liked or something of the sort, and he got hit in the eye with a baseball. Immediate sort of a sympathy computation goes in. You're dropped because this is bad news. Did you ever stop and think of why it's bad news to you that he got hit in the eye with a baseball? So what? So he got hit in the eye with a baseball. Does this hurt your food supply line? You can always find another canasta player. But you see, you're fully responsible, inherently. So you just say, well, that's fine. My responsibility, I must be to blame. I didn't keep the baseball from hitting him in the eye. And you can even work with people for a while, and they will finally come up with some dopey explanation of how it was their fault. Well, they intended to call him on Saturday and see whether or not he couldn't play a game of golf that day. And by not calling him, therefore, there he was out playing baseball with the kids, and that's how he got hit in the eye with a baseball, and that's why it's my fault. But the reason you haven't looked at very many of these rationalizations, why? Because they're tied up in emotional curves. Little kid's out playing, life's going along all right. Suddenly, his mother comes out. And she looks very, very sad, very sorrowful. He says, what's the matter, Mommy? What's the matter, Mommy? What's the matter, Mommy? She says, nothing. Meantime, increasing his tension terrifically, she gets him built up to a tremendous level of anxiety and then pops it. Grandpa just died. Now, this kid knows Grandpa. He's sat around occasionally on a little footstool, and he said, gee, I wish Grandpa's rheumatiz didn't hurt. I wish I could see for Grandpa a little better. Gosh, he sure has a lot of trouble getting the car started. I think I'll invent a self-starter for him or something. Yeah. I think I'll get rich. I think I'll get rich and I'll have a big castle. And I'll store one whole room with chewing tobacco. So he'll never be out of chewing tobacco because he always seems to get out of it when he wants some. This kid knows Grandpa. So subject, group, Grandpa, habits, somatics of Grandpa, counter efforts must be duplicated because the first reaction of the kid is to say, it's not so. I do not believe it. It can't be true. Invalidation, effort of invalidation, and this effort of invalidation comes with a crash afterwards. Bang, that goes down too, which just drives it home further. When he says, I can't believe this, and I don't want to believe this, and this isn't true, and all that sort of thing, people then quietly, solemnly, quietly, solemnly, very quietly convince him it's true. Let's not have any fast music around the dead. Let's not do anything very exciting. I don't think you ought to go to the show this afternoon, Johnny. After all, it's only been 2 weeks since your grandfather died. Let's keep him running slow. And he'll keep picking these somatics up. They're not grandpa's, they're his. But now you run this emotional curve. Now you know there are occluded deaths on cases. By the way, there isn't a case here that doesn't have two or three deaths that you aren't consciously aware of having happened in your vicinity. But how do you make the individual aware that they did happen? Not by trying to sell him on the idea and going and get a Bible. Let's not be psychoanalysts. Let's not go get a Bible and show them in there, look, your grandpapa died at such and such a date because it says right there in the front of the Bible, so therefore it's true. All right, you're well now. Next customer. Wrong deal. If there were an automatic process which would immediately reveal to the individual these incidents, would reveal to him the times when he blamed himself for the death, and would reveal to him the times when he had tried to defend the death, and would bring to view his thoughts, which he thought with regard to his desire for approval or his desire to give approval to Grandpa to go on living, wouldn't that be a very valuable technique? Particularly in view of the fact you can see Grandpa's glasses on this pretty clear, and Grandpa's habits on this pretty clear, and Grandpa's everything on this pretty clear, including Grandpa's consistent business failure. Guys will go on failing in businesses just for Grandpa. They'll go on being professionally something else just for Grandpa. More important than that, they will go on walking like a horse or something of the sort for dear old Bessie or something that died when they were 2 years old, back in the Middle West farm horse. How would you like a technique that did that? Well, it's a very simple technique. You just run the emotional curve. That's all. You just insist on running the emotional curve. And the regret comes out, and the blame comes out, and the thought behind it comes out, and it falls out of this darn curve. You remember the time your grandfather died? No. Well, how would you have felt just before you found out he died? All right, I guess. How would you have felt just after? It's all terrible. Well, how do you feel when you're all right? Oh, I feel all right. How do you feel when you feel terrible? Well, well, can you get the drop between those two? Can you feel all right and then feel terrible? Feel all right and feel terrible? Yeah. Now, here's that time I hit that boy over the head with a club. Knocked him out. I didn't mean to. You start picking up incidents of that magnitude, which is minor magnitude. And you'll pick up more incidents and more incidents and more incidents of greater and greater magnitude till all of a sudden you've got deaths on the case the person didn't know anything about. Much less the deaths he knew about. But if you have one of these occluded deaths, you start running it and you'll find out just where he blamed himself for that death. And they all do. That's what's rough on soldiers. The field of battle. They go charging over the top into a flock of machine gun bullets and something of the sort, and guys fall here and guys fall there and guys fall someplace else. Well, they're responsible for all those deaths. Each one of them is, really. He gets over into the enemy trench and then he kills another human being. And he's responsible for that one, too. So he can't win. War is a nice game by which you keep people down the tone scale so that you can govern them very well. I don't think a national government could actually exist without the threat of war if there weren't an aggressor around. Well, there are aggressors around, and you do have to have something to prevent them because everybody's working on this same circle. But you see what happens. Now this guy finally hardens himself into it, and he sells himself this bill of goods. Well, I'm me. I don't care who else I am. And then he gives himself a snide satisfaction for having eaten the lunch of the guy in the next bed in the hospital where they both were. The guy was his buddy. He gets his buddy's lunch. Food was kind of scarce there, and his buddy died at 11:30, so he got his lunch. You get this guy actually holding such incidents in, saying, I am tough, I am hard, I can stand up to all of this, nothing of this can shake me. And he keeps telling himself this, and the next thing you know, nothing can. Not even life. He doesn't enjoy anything anymore, by the way. But he sure is tough. You run into this case every once in a while. You try to run an emotional curve on one, and it's like trying to open up brick pavement with a toothpick. Until all of a sudden, you start triggering approval or regret. This case is never closed down so tight that you can't find some regret for something on it. And you start running that off a little bit, and first thing you know, the rest of your case starts to open up. Now, I'll give you just a momentary review of this thing. What is survival? Survival is a right to survive which an individual gives himself automatically. When he is his own right to survive, he is very fully responsible. And this operates in the society as approval. When some other thing on some other dynamic fails to survive, an individual holds himself responsible for that failure. When he actually can demonstrate to himself that he definitely was responsible for it, you don't get it just as an esoteric mechanism. You get it as an actual fact, and he goes into sympathy on that dynamic. And he will stay sympathetic toward that dynamic, and he will stay down tone scale with that dynamic, and he will keep on asking that part of that dynamic for his own survival.